So we're going to be looking this evening then at that passage that I read a few moments ago, Ruth chapter 2, verses 1 to 17. Now I said a few weeks ago that Ruth is not perhaps quite the demure young lady that we often picture her to be. Certainly in chapter 1 there's a certain feistiness to her character in the way that she flatly defies Naomi's orders. Naomi tells her to go back to Moab and Ruth tells her, no, I'm not going to do that. And similarly here now as we enter chapter 2, we perhaps don't see a feistiness in her, but we do see certainly a confidence, a forwardness in this woman, Ruth. So straight away we see that she doesn't wait, does she? Now they've arrived in Bethlehem. She doesn't wait to be guided by Naomi as to what she's going to do and particularly how she's going to earn a living for them both. But she takes the initiative. She says, or she indicates to Naomi that she would like to go and do some gleaning in the fields, this business of gleaning. As I'm sure you're aware then, it was what the poor did in Israel. They were given rights in the law of Moses to do this, to go into the harvest fields and to follow the reapers and to basically pick up then bits that either were missed by the reapers or bits that were dropped and left behind in that way by the reapers. And so here then we have Ruth straight away, and as I say, there's a forwardness about her, a confidence as she takes initiative. Naomi, I would like to go and do this. But then when she's actually arrived in the fields of Bethlehem, then again we see an even greater degree actually of forwardness. The way that she approaches this is really quite extraordinary. In verse 7 we have the foreman, the kind of the chief servant in that field under Boaz's employment. We have him reporting to Boaz what Ruth has been up to that morning. And notice he tells Boaz there, verse 7, that she came to me, Ruth came to me, and she said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. Now that might not mean all that much to us, but this word sheaves there, it refers then to the bundles of of stalks that the reapers then would gather together. So they would pick up a bundle, then they would pick up too much to be able to carry it any longer, and they would put it down and that would be tied into a bundle. Then they would start a new pile and they would tie that one up as another bundle. And those were the sheaves, those bundles. And it seems then, from what we know of this custom, that these bundles, these sheaves, they would be kind of assembled in the middle of the field. And the gleaners then, they weren't allowed to go too near the middle of the field. They had to kind of stay at the margins of the field and glean there. And the reason was so that they couldn't go and basically steal from the bundles. Yes, they were allowed to pick up bits that had been left on the ground, but they mustn't go and start stealing from these gathered bundles. And that seems to have been the custom. And yet here's Ruth, and she's saying, well, can I go and actually glean among the sheaves, where no gleaners were allowed normally to go? But she's come up then with this very forward, this very confident request. Now, it may be that Ruth, as an outsider, was just unaware of this custom. But the very fact she asked permission at all seems to suggest she was aware she was asking for something out of the ordinary. And as I say then, it seems to suggest that there's a certain confidence about her. But if then we have indications here of confidence and forwardness in Ruth, there are other indications that's not quite the whole story. That beneath this exterior of confidence, she's somewhat less assured. So in verse 10, she seems keenly aware, doesn't she, of her outsider status. She says to Boaz, since I am a foreigner, She's very aware she's not a local, that she is a foreigner, with all the vulnerability that that outsider status no doubt brought with it. Or then in verse 13, you'll notice, she refers to Boaz's words having comforted her, which suggests that she had arrived actually in that field this morning. For all her apparent confidence, she had arrived with many anxieties and misgivings within. And Boaz had allayed those and comforted her. And so, against that backdrop then, of Ruth's fears, that at best she might just be refused access to the harvest field, at worst she might actually be abused and exploited, against that backdrop, instead what we have here is Ruth being treated amazingly well, don't we? So decently, so humanely, so advantageously by this Bethlehemite farmer, Boaz. And you can almost sense the bemusement, can't you, in her own voice there in verse 10, as she says to Boaz, "Why have I found favor in your eyes?" She had come that morning, yes, looking confident, but actually within, probably expecting things were going to be tough that day. And she's saying, "Why have you treated me like this? Why on earth have you been so good to me?" You can sense, as I say, the bemusement in her voice. And this evening then, I would like to take that question of Ruth's there in verse 10. I would like to take that as our focal point. And I would like us to consider why indeed Boaz has treated Ruth so well. Why? This random Moabite, this outsider who has turned up in his field, why is he so good to her? Why does he treat her in such a decent and more than decent way? I want us to consider that question. Now, I suppose if some Hollywood film director were to produce a screen version of the story of Ruth, I'm sure it would be very obvious why Boaz was treating Ruth in this way. I'm sure Ruth would be played by some very attractive looking woman, and I'm sure that from the moment Boaz enters the field and asks, "Whose young woman is that?" it would be clear from his facial expression, it would be clear from his tone of voice as he says to her in verse 8, "Listen, my daughter, don't leave this field." It would be clear that he is head over heels with love for this woman. He's fallen for her. That he has been captivated by Ruth. And you can imagine the background music that would be played and the somewhat exaggerated beauty of this rural setting. And you can imagine then the romantic atmosphere that we would have in the Hollywood version of this. In other words, Hollywood's answer to our question, why is Boaz treating Ruth like this, will be that Boaz has fallen for her. And I think in as far as it goes, that answer is probably correct. And it may well be that Ruth was a very attractive looking woman. Certainly she seems to have worked her magic, doesn't she, on the foreman, on the servant there in verses 6 and 7, because he's not indignant with her, even though she's come with such a forward request, "I want to gather among the sheaves." He hasn't shooed her away. "Go away, you don't do things like that, you're a Moabite." And we're told in chapter 3 verse 10, or it's indicated in chapter 3 verse 10, that Ruth was desirable for the young men of Bethlehem. So she may well have been attractive looking. And at the end of the day, Ruth is a love story. This book is a love story. And we'll come back to that later this evening. So insofar as it goes, the Hollywood answer that Boaz has fallen for her, he's captivated by her, insofar as it goes, that's probably correct. But I stress, insofar as it goes. Because clearly, this is not just another love story. There's more going on here than just a man and a woman falling for each other and marrying. And that's just as well, really, because if it were just another love story, we've come to the wrong place this evening. We'd be better going to the English Literature Department at Newcastle University and listening to a lecture there on Ruth as a love story. We'd get a much better analysis of it as a love story there. But there's more going on, I'm saying. And so I want us to consider three deeper answers to this question. Why has Ruth found favour in Boaz's eyes? Why is Boaz treating her so well? Yes, possibly he's been captivated by her. But there are also three deeper answers to the question. Answer number one. In answer to a devout prayer. Why is he treating her like this? In answer to a devout prayer. Now, last time, you may remember, 2 weeks ago, we talked about Naomi a lot. And we talked about Naomi's confusion. The way in which Naomi, you remember, was looking at her circumstances and judging everything for her, from her circumstances, and thinking then that God was against her, God was angry with her because things had gone so badly in her life. So we talked about Naomi's confusion, but remember we said that before we came to Naomi's confusion, we must notice something that was very creditable and commendable about Naomi. Her assumption. And do you remember what that assumption was? Naomi assumed that Yahweh, that Jehovah, was totally in control of everything. And even though her husband and her two sons had died on Moabite soil, she didn't think that it was Chemosh, the god of Moab's doing, that he was the one who had taken the lives of those three men. No, it was Yahweh who had done it. It was Jehovah who had done it. And so, in other words, she doesn't see that the world has been full of gods. And you have a god that rules over events in this country and another god that rules over events in this country. No, she knew that there's only one God who governs all events everywhere. And in a similar vein to that is Naomi's prayer, which we didn't really comment on when we covered it several weeks ago now, in chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Notice there in chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, we have Naomi sending her daughters-in-law back to Moab, or trying to send them back to Moab. And in that connection, she prays for them. And she prays that they will get new husbands back there in Moab, who will provide them with good homes. But interestingly, again, you see, she doesn't pray that Chemosh, the god of Moab, that he'll provide husbands for them back there in Moab. No, she prays that the Lord, block capitals there, Yahweh, Jehovah, that he will provide husbands for these women. And again, then, it's commendable that, isn't it? We can easily be very down on Naomi. But again, we need to notice she's a woman who understands the sovereignty of Jehovah. And that's reflected in that prayer. So it's a devout prayer that she prays there in chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Now, we don't know, do we, what happened to Orpah after that. Orpah disappears from the book. Orpah disappears from the stage altogether. And we don't know what her subsequent life story was. But we do know that here now in chapter 2, in this field, Naomi's prayer starts to be answered with regard to Ruth, at least. And in fact, we have a verbal connection showing that this is Naomi's prayer starting to be answered. Because we have that same verb, find, don't we? Remember, Naomi had prayed back there in chapter 1 that these women would find rest. She had prayed for Ruth that Ruth would find rest in the home of in the house of her husband. And here now we have Ruth in chapter 2, verse 10, saying, "Why have I found favor in your eyes?" So at this point, Ruth still hasn't found full rest in Boaz's house. We haven't got to that point yet. But she's on the way there. She's found favor in his eyes. And she's on the way then now to finding that rest in his house that Naomi had prayed for back in chapter 1. And so I'm saying then that it's more here than just a romantic attraction that's pulling these two individuals, Boaz and Ruth, together. That's the Hollywood version of events. And it's true insofar as it goes. But there's more going on. There's prayer involved. Somebody had prayed for this. Naomi had prayed. And that prayer has been answered. And that's part of the equation here. But of course there's something else that needs to be said, isn't there? Naomi's prayer here isn't being answered in the way that Naomi had envisaged when she had prayed it. Because, of course, when Naomi had prayed for Ruth back there in chapter 1, she had envisaged that the husband she was praying for would be a Moabite man. As I say, she was sending Ruth back to Moab. She had envisaged a Moabite man marrying Ruth. And, yes, a good Moabite man, by that same common grace we talked about a few weeks ago, whereby Ruth and Orpah, even as pagans, it seems, were good women. And she's praying then for a good Moabite man to marry Ruth, someone who will indeed provide rest for her. But nonetheless, it's a Moabite man that she's envisaging marrying Ruth. A man who will marry Ruth and take Ruth into a house where probably in the corner of every room there'll be a shrine dedicated to Chemosh. A man who, if he's very religious, may even take the children that Ruth bears him and sacrifice them in the flames to the god Chemosh. That's what Naomi has in mind as she prays for Ruth there in chapter 1. How much better than that is the answer that God is giving now? Here's Ruth now, and she's not in Moab, she's in Bethlehem. And this husband who's emerging onto the scene, he's not a Moabite, he's an Israelite. The very first spoken word by Boaz in this story is Yahweh, the Lord. And the child that Ruth will bear to Boaz, he'll not sacrifice to the flames. That child will be an ancestor, no less, of the Messiah himself. Isn't this Ephesians 3:20 in action? Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think. Naomi couldn't have envisaged how her prayer was going to be answered. At best, she hoped that Ruth would find a lovely Moabite husband. And here we have now Ruth being given this Israelite husband who is so much better than anything Naomi could have dreamt of. And we know Ephesians 3:20, but do we really believe it? The God who is able to do far more abundantly than all we ask or imagine. If we really believe that, wouldn't it transform our whole attitude to prayer? Wouldn't it transform our whole attitude to our Wednesday prayer meeting here? Wouldn't we look at things very differently if we really believed in this God written of by Paul, demonstrated in the experience of Naomi, who takes the prayers of his people and doesn't just give one-for-one answers, but actually goes beyond, far beyond. And so that's the first thing we must notice tonight. Why is Boaz treating Ruth like this in answer to a devout prayer? But secondly, in fulfillment of a divine purpose. In fulfillment of a divine purpose. Let's just step back for a moment and get our bearings again with regard to this book of Ruth. How does it fit into the Bible story, the one story from Genesis to Revelation? Well, remember, we've said this several times. This is God providing a king for his people. King David, the last word of the book of Ruth. This is God providing King David for his people. And he's doing it then in the way that so often he provides key figures in his unfolding story of redemption. He's doing it through a barren woman. And in this case, the barren woman is Naomi. That's her situation, isn't it, in chapter 1, verse 5. She hadn't been barren. She'd had a husband, she'd had two sons, but they'd been stripped from her. And as she stands in chapter 1, verse 5, she's a barren woman. And yet it's through her that God is going to provide King David. And he's going to do it then, not in this case, as in other cases in the scriptures, not in this case through a miraculous conception. But he's going to do it in this case through Ruth. And through Ruth then marrying Boaz and having Naomi's child for her, so that it can be announced in chapter 4, verse 17, a son has been born to Naomi. But we've stressed, haven't we, that although then God doesn't do this miraculously in the technical sense, there's no miracle here, as you have with a Sarah or a Mary or an Elizabeth. Although he doesn't do it miraculously in the technical sense, it's nonetheless a remarkable process, isn't it? By which God does this, by which God gives a child to Naomi. And we talked then a few weeks ago about how God had to work dramatically within Ruth to make this happen. Even to the extent of regenerating her pagan heart. In order to make her the means by which this child could be born, God had to actually reach, as it were, deep into Ruth's heart and change her deep down there. But not only that, in order to make this whole thing happen, God had to work dramatically in the sequence of events, didn't he? And this is what's really emphasized here then in our passage. You see, let's be clear on this. It had to be Boaz that Ruth married. It couldn't just be any old man from Bethlehem with whom she had a child. Because that's the whole significance, and we'll talk about this later on, of course, in a subsequent study. That's the whole significance of this business of the kinsman that is stressed later on. Boaz was a kinsman, and therefore he was legally able to marry and have children for Elimelech and Naomi, to perpetuate Elimelech and Naomi's line. Some other random guy from Bethlehem couldn't have done that. Only Boaz could, because of his relationship to the family. And so if Ruth is going to have a child for Naomi, it has to be through marrying Boaz. And yet here she is now on day one in Bethlehem, stepping out of the door, going to the fields. Now remember, this is Bethlehem. Bethlehem means house of bread. So fields in Bethlehem are like bookshops in Hay on Wye, or Indian restaurants in Ocean Road or wherever it is, in South Shields. I mean, Bethlehem specializes in fields. There are fields everywhere. And here she is then, just stepping randomly out of a door, looking for a field where she can start gleaning. Could have been any field stepped into, and then just stayed there the rest of her working life. But we're told, aren't we, in verse 3, those wonderful words, she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. And you can see the writer's writing there with great irony, isn't he? He's writing with tongue in cheek. He knows it's not just happened, it's not just luck, it's not just a stroke of fortune. He's just told us through the words of Naomi at the end of chapter 1 that Yahweh is sovereign over everything. He was the one who took the lives of Elimelech and Mahlon and Chilion. And if he's sovereign over the deaths of those men, he's equally sovereign over which field Ruth steps into that morning. And again then, it's reminding us that it's more than just romantic attraction pulling Boaz and Ruth together here, like in the movie. But there's another huge factor behind this. Yes, God is answering prayer, but also God is fulfilling his great purpose to provide a king for his people. And so, if it's Ephesians 3:20 in action, it's also Ephesians 1:11 in action, isn't it? Where Paul speaks of the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will. All things, including then this sequence of events that brought Ruth and Boaz together. Which field she stepped into that morning, God is working it all according to the counsel of his will. And isn't that an exciting truth then? That God is working all things, even the smallest things, the most apparently random things, the most minute and intricate details. He's working all things according to the counsel of his will. There are these films like Sliding Doors and The Family Man and others that are based on the premise then that our lives are made up of a whole endless series of situations where just a different decision here or a slightly minusculely different turn of events there would have led our lives off on a completely different trajectory, and that could just as easily have happened as the trajectory that our lives did go off on. And it's all just basically the flick of a coin. And we can easily think like that, can't we? As you trudge into work tomorrow morning. If only I'd got a couple more marks in that exam 25 years ago, then I would perhaps have gone to university or to a different university. And then perhaps I would have gone and got a different job in a warmer part of the country. And I wouldn't be miserable here on this Monday morning walking into this place in Newcastle. You can easily think like that. And Scripture says no. The exam mark and the university or the non-university, the job, the place, it's all part of God working out the counsel of his will. The counsel of his will, which Ephesians 1 also says, as we started our service tonight, will culminate in the whole cosmos being brought together under the lordship of Jesus Christ. Everything is contributing to that plan, to that end. There are no coincidences, no accidents. It's all God working things to his purposed end. So, why is Boaz treating Ruth like this? Well, it's in answer to a devout prayer. It's in fulfillment of a divine purpose. But then thirdly and finally, it's in keeping with a developing portrait. It's in keeping with a developing portrait. You see, in this story then, of Ruth, we have not only God paving the way for the king that he's going to provide. We have more than that. We also have God developing a portrait of the king he's going to provide. And I don't mean now King David, actually. I mean the king he was going to provide. David's greater son. Because, of course, it's not David who's the ultimate answer, is it, to the last verse of Judges. In those days, there was no king, and so everyone did what was right in their own eyes. David isn't the true answer. David is a provisional answer. Jesus is the true answer. Jesus is the real king. God is in the process here of providing for his people. And here, then, in this book, we have not only God kind of arranging all that, paving the way for it, but we even have him giving a little portrait of that coming King Jesus. And it's a sketchy portrait, and it's an imperfect portrait, but it's a real portrait. And that portrait then is this man, Boaz. And he's a very distinctive portrait. We have that interesting initial description of him in verse 1 of chapter 2. He was a worthy man. That phrase, that Hebrew phrase, is used elsewhere in the Old Testament, and it has a range of meanings. One meaning it has often is war hero, military hero. And one use of it quite close to this in terms of biblical positioning is Judges chapter 6 verse 12, where it's used of Gideon. The same phrase is used of him, and there, of course, it does mean war hero. That fits with him. He was a man who led Israel to war and to a great military victory, as of course did so many of the other judges. Those judges were like Samson and Gideon and Othniel and Jephthah. They were war heroes. They were conquerors who conquered God's enemies and liberated God's people from those enemies. And in that way, they all pictured, didn't they, the coming King Jesus Christ, who would be the ultimate conqueror, who would rescue God's people from their enemies. And we come then to Ruth chapter 2 verse 1. And it's so close to the book of Judges, and we've had that introductory comment in the first verse of the book, that this is the period of the judges. And so you're kind of expecting that Boaz is going to be another worthy man in that sense. He's going to be another war hero. He's going to be another Gideon. He's going to be another Samson. He's going to be another Jephthah. And he's going to picture then Jesus in that way. But of course he doesn't. You read the book and there's no war, there's no battle. He doesn't assemble an army and go and attack somebody. But Boaz, I would put to you, Boaz actually complements those figures in the book of Judges. They all picture Jesus in that very specific way of being conquerors of God's enemies, liberators. But they don't really picture Jesus in any other way, do they? They're a pretty motley bunch of guys. Boaz, on the other hand, he doesn't picture Jesus in that way of being a conqueror, not at all, or hardly at all. But he pictures Jesus in some of the ways that they all fail to picture Jesus. How? Well, let's close with just a few ways then. First of all, notice Boaz is a reformer. He's a reformer. So this is the period of the judges. Let's always keep that in mind. This is the days of the judges. What does that mean? That means darkness, doesn't it? Moral and spiritual darkness. This is a black period in Israel's history. Not only is this the period of the judges, this is Bethlehem. We've read about Bethlehem just recently, if you're reading through the Bible, I mean, in the last few chapters of Judges. And we've been introduced there in the last two chapters of Judges to two very shady characters from Bethlehem. One was a Levite, and he lived in Bethlehem, and he actually then left Bethlehem, and he went wandering off, and he ended up living with a chap called Micah, and becoming Micah's household priest. And there in Micah's house, presiding over a shrine of different gods. This is a Levite from Bethlehem, and he's presiding over a shrine of different gods, household gods, in this guy Micah's house. And if that wasn't bad enough, then a bit later on, a whole load of people from the tribe of Dan come along, and they bribe this Levite, this priest, and they say, look, actually, we'll give you more money and a bit more prestige than Micah can give you as a priest, so come with us. And so he just goes off with them for a bit more prestige and a bit more money and steals some of Micah's gods in the process. He's a shady character, and he is from Bethlehem. Then we meet a concubine in chapter 19 of Judges, and she has a very rightful claim to our sympathy, because one of the worst episodes of a sexual assault in the whole of the Bible was perpetrated against her. And she's a pathetic woman, and very nasty things happened to her. But before all that, at the beginning of Judges 19, she actually is unfaithful to her partner. And so she's a shady character as well. And they're both from Bethlehem. And so it seems then that that's the moral climate of this town of Bethlehem. It's typical, a typical judge's town, if you like. A typical town during the period of the judges. Things are dark there. Things are black there. With one exception, it seems. And that's Boaz's field. And if that's the climate of Bethlehem generally, it seems like there's a microclimate, morally speaking, in Bethlehem's field. Things are different there. Look at his morning routine as he turns up at work. He doesn't start discussing profit margins with his foreman. But he comes along and he says, "The Lord be with you," to his staff. And then they all reply, "The Lord bless you." It seems like this man, he's somehow managing to promote righteousness. Even in dark Bethlehem, within his field, righteousness prevails. Godliness prevails. Good, Yahweh-centered ethics prevail in Bethlehem, in Boaz's fields. He's a promoter of righteousness. And that's precisely what Samson and Gideon and these other guys couldn't do, wasn't it? They could liberate God's people from enemies. They were good at smashing the opposition. They were good at showing strength and brutality and good military men, but they couldn't promote godliness. And yet here's Boaz, and he can create this little microclimate around him of godliness there in Bethlehem. And isn't that picture Jesus? A king who not only liberates us from our enemies at the cross, crushes the head of the serpent in a stronger way than any Samson or Gideon ever did, but also promotes righteousness in his people. He liberates and he promotes righteousness. As we were thinking this morning, he makes us holy. He sanctifies us. He changes our hearts. He's a reformer in the truest sense. In that way, Boaz pictures Jesus. Secondly, he's a protector. He's a protector. Look at verse 8, where he is so insistent to Boaz, to Ruth, that you stay in this field. And yes, perhaps he fancies this woman, but at the same time, he's offering her protection, isn't he? That's confirmed by Naomi's words in verse 22. Don't go into another field because you'll be assaulted there. Because that's the climate in the other areas of this town. And so here's Boaz protecting Ruth, picturing in a small way the great king to come, the one who would say of his sheep in John 10:28, "No one can snatch them from my hand." Should all the hosts of death and powers of hell unknown put their most dreadful forms of rage and malice on, I shall be safe, for Christ displays superior power and guardian grace. We have a strong protector in Jesus Christ, don't we? Every day we are surrounded, we can't see it, but we're surrounded by demons and spirits belonging to Satan. He's trying to attack us and assault us. And we have this protector king, Jesus. And Boaz faintly pictures him. Thirdly, he's a benefactor. His generosity here is staggering, isn't it? For one, there in verse 15. And this is, by the way, how we know that it was very unusual. Or one way we know it was unusual for the gleaners to glean among the sheaves. Because Boaz says there in verse 15, doesn't he? "Let her glean even among the sheaves." He uses the word even there. So this was unusual. Gleaners didn't normally glean among the sheaves. But this is what Ruth had asked for. And this now is what Boaz is saying she can do. He's permitting it. And then verse 16, he goes even further, doesn't he? So he actually pull out some bits for her. Give her some extra stuff. This is why she has such an extraordinary yield. In verse 17, she goes home with about an ephah of barley. Apparently that was the equivalent of half a month's wages. This was an astonishing day's work in the field, because Boaz has been so generous in these different ways. In verse 9, he tells her she can drink from the men's drinks. Verse 14, he even tells her to come and eat with him and the other workers. There's a generosity, a liberality about him. And again, picturing the coming king, Jesus, the one from whose fullness we have received grace upon grace, John says, John 1:16. our generous King. We're blessed with every spiritual blessing, Ephesians 1:3, in the heavenly realms. He's just always pouring out blessings on us, isn't he? And Boaz pictures that. Fourthly, he's an intercessor. He prays for her there in verse 12. He prays that the Lord will give her her full reward. Interesting language that. I think again it probably connects with the Abraham thing that we talked about a few weeks ago. And Ruth here is following in Abraham's footsteps. And he went from Ur to Canaan. She's gone from Moab to Canaan, or Israel as it's now called, of course. But just as for Abraham, even once he got there, that wasn't really his full reward. Hebrews 11 says his full reward was a heavenly country. Canaan was just a little picture of a heavenly country. That was his full reward. And here, I think it's the same with Ruth, that she's traveled to Israel. She's there now, but that's not her full reward. She, like Abraham, has faith in a heavenly country. It's an eternal inheritance that she is in line for. And here's Boaz, and he's praying that the Lord will give her that eternal inheritance, her full reward. And Jesus is praying that for us tonight, isn't he? And he's doing it in a better way than Boaz could. He's doing it on the basis of his own sacrifice. And he's saying, Father, give them. Give to these people in NREC tonight. Give them their full reward, their eternal inheritance on the basis of my shed blood. But then fifthly and finally, he's a lover. This is where we started tonight. And as I said, the Hollywood director would be right. Most probably. And there are hints, I think, in our passage that there is a romance developing. Verse 11 is interesting, how Boaz echoes the language of Genesis 2:24 about leaving father and mother to be married. It's the only other place we have the phrase. We have it in Genesis 2:24 and we have it here in Ruth 2:11. Ruth has left her father and mother. Boaz is using their language that was associated with marriage in the Old Testament. And then verse 13, Ruth says that you have spoken kindly to your servant. It's stronger than that. It's spoken tenderly. It's, again, romantic, affectionate language. This is Boaz, it seems then, wooing, courting this woman. And again, picturing the King who would come, Jesus Christ, who doesn't just rule over his people in a cold and distant way, but who woos us, who sweeps us off our feet, who draws us to himself in a love relationship. The King of love, my shepherd, is. And so I just want to close tonight asking, is this your King? Is Boaz a picture, an Old Testament picture of your King tonight? And if not, if Jesus isn't your King, he can be. And the great thing here about Ruth is that she is an outsider. She's this foreigner. She's disadvantaged, it seems. And yet, Boaz doesn't care about that. And similarly tonight, you might think, well, I'm ineligible for King Jesus because of my background. I'm not from a Christian background. I've had a terrible past. It's been rough. It's been checkered in so many ways, but Jesus will be your King tonight if you will come and bow to him and say to him, King of my life, I crown you now. Amen.